This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Boris Johnson delivers his farewell speech as the UK Prime Minister ahead of the takeover of power by Liz Truss. The European Union's top diplomat advises EU states to stock up on weapons as their arsenals are running out due to oversupplying Ukraine with arms. And also, Israel is advancing plans to build hundreds of settler apartments in Al-Quds, encroaching on a Palestinian neighborhood. Hello and welcome, everybody. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson leaves Downing Street nearly 2 months after mass resignations in his cabinet forced him to step down as Conservative Party leader. In a farewell address, Johnson said he has, quote, fulfilled his function as prime minister. He pointed to Britain's economic hardship, saying his successor would do everything to help people cope with rising energy prices. That's amid a soaring cost of living crisis and a two-digit inflation figure. Johnson's government was rocked by a series of scandals, including the so-called Partygate, before he tendered his resignation in July. The Conservative Party elected Finance Secretary Liz Truss as its new leader on Monday. She will officially take office after confirmation by the Queen later today. Well, to give us better insight on the recent events in British politics, we're joined by our correspondent, Syed Purezo, who's joining us from the British capital, London. And we also have Professor of Economics Rodney Shakespeare, who's also with us from the British capital. Let's start off with our very own Syed in London. Syed, Boris Johnson has, as usual, delivered a pompous speech. We covered that a few hours ago, putting his trust in trust and saying that Britain is a country with economic strength and Britons will come out stronger from this crisis. Is the future as rosy as Johnson pictured it?
The short answer is no. But again, the jury is out on that, given the reality on the ground. As you say, we heard Boris Johnson deliver his farewell speech in the early hours of this morning, the same with the same pompous way that he has always done, and really not a note of contrition in his speech about all the things that transpired that led to his July 7th resignation, such as the parties at Downing Street, as well as allegations of financial impropriety and bad judgment. By that of reference, of course, to the Owen Paterson affair, an MP that violated lobbying rules in favor of a pharmaceuticals company, and hiring a MP with a history of sexual misconduct as deputy whip. All those things that brought his downfall. But Liz Truss, despite the fact that we heard Boris Johnson, it's time to put politics aside and unite behind Liz Truss, she is inheriting a very divided Conservative Party, as we have seen over the past year, at least. How that transpired, how the different party members reacted to the different allegations against Boris Johnson, and an economy that is really faltering. It is effectively in recession, as announced by the Bank of England recently. Inflation that is already in the double digits, expected to go higher all the way to some estimates to 22 or 24% in the next year. You're looking also at the cost of living crisis, energy prices that have skyrocketed in first time in decades, that meaning pushing families millions of families, individuals into poverty, Britain now being a country where already 10 million people are reportedly living in absolute poverty. We're looking at another 3 million being added to that figure. You're looking at an increase in the number of children who live in relative poverty, among other things. Even the signature policy or agenda of the Conservative Party, the so-called leveling up agenda, which means basically providing areas that feel left out with an opportunity to catch up with the rest of the country. There are economists, observers saying that that also has been a failure, despite the fact that Boris Johnson, as we heard this morning, didn't think so, and instead focused on what he thought was his delivering on his mandate on the Conservative Party manifesto. We also heard him, for example, only focus on the vaccine rollout, as well as his support for the war in Ukraine. Those are the two only things that he talked about at the top of his speech. There was really nothing left to show for him as prime minister in his brief stay at number 10 Downing Street as prime minister. So it's a divided party and a difficult road ahead for Liz Truss.
Let's bring in Rodney Shakespeare on the discussion as well. Mr. Shakespeare, taking on the leadership of a country as deep in trouble as the UK is today, is that a blessing or a curse for Liz Truss?
It is now a disaster area, and that has been created by Boris Johnson, who thinks he's Winston Churchill, and Truss, who thinks she's Margaret Thatcher. And because of that, they are incapable, completely incapable of getting out of the situation, which they are going to make worse. The basic situation starts 25 years ago with the eastward march of NATO, 2014 fascist coup, and then before the invasion, Zelensky was saying Ukraine will go into NATO and it will have atom bombs on its soil. After that, the invasion of Ukraine became inevitable, and neither Johnson now, nor Truss, nor the Conservative Party, nor the Labour Party, nor the Liberal Party, nor the Scottish Nationalists are waking up to the cause, the big cause of that inflation. Now, Said said somewhere between 20 and 22%, round there, inflation, yes, and helping people with their electricity bills is not going to stop that inflation. So the country is locked in disaster. Truss and the Conservatives have no solution, nor do the others. The only way forward is to address the situation in the first place in Ukraine.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Saeed Puruza is joining us from London. Also thanks to Professor of Economics Rodney Shakespeare, also joining us from the British capital. Moving on, the European Union's foreign policy chief says member states are running low on weapons because of the scale of arms deliveries to Ukraine.
The military stocks of most member states has been, I wouldn't say exhausted, but depleted in a high proportion because we have been providing a lot of capacity to the Ukrainians.
Borrell also said he regrets that the EU did not begin training Ukrainian forces a year ago when some member states called for it. This follows informal discussions last week on an EU-level military training mission in Ukraine. The EU has already provided 2.5 billion euros in military assistance to Ukraine since the war began in the country last February. The figure includes a 500 million euro aid package approved in July. Activist and political analyst John Bosnich joins us now from Belgrade. Mr. Bosnich, welcome to the program, if you're with us. So the European Union is supporting Ukraine with massive arms packages to the point of depleting its own arsenals. European states are also sanctioning Russia at the price of leaving their own people without enough fuel for the winter. The question is, how much is Europe losing in all of this?
Well, Europe is losing something that's worth more than money, and that is its independence. Europe was attempting to become some sort of an independent entity between Russia and the United States. And as a result of this crisis that they themselves have provoked in Ukraine, they have now been folded back under American total control. I don't know what money value you can put on that, but it's far more than the budgets of all the European countries put together.
And Western suppliers, especially the U.S., have started supplying Ukraine with more and more advanced and destructive weapons. Russia, for its part, is warning that they risk becoming a direct party to the war. How serious do you see that risk? And, of course, if this war lasts any longer, is there any chance that it could spill over to other areas and regions?
Well, the risk is rising, and that's because of United States pressure on Germany and other countries to get themselves directly involved in the conflict. So that risk rises as much as America pushes its colonies, which the EU has become, as much as it pushes the colonies to do what it says. Now, the people in Europe are demonstrating. There are great numbers of people who are opposed to this situation, and that is the dampening factor which might reduce the risk. In the meantime, Russia is showing on the battlefield that the battle is so lopsided that for Europe to enter on the Ukrainian side, it would involve a serious multi-state war that would probably be called another world war. Whether it would become an atomic world war is not yet known, but this is definitely the threat of a world war that would spread from the local region to other areas around the world, other areas of conflict. This is a very, very dangerous crisis.
All right, thanks a lot, activist and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade. Elsewhere, Israel announces plans to build a new settlement across the Green Line in Al-Quds. The settlement is planned to include 700 residential units as well as a synagogue. The project will be constructed just meters away from the Palestinian village of Beit Safafa, southeast of Al-Quds. This move occupied the last undeveloped plot of land in the village. Beit Safafa is almost entirely encircled by settlements. Israel has recently sped up its settlement construction on Palestinian lands despite international outcry. All Israeli settlements are deemed illegal under international law. Political commentator Saad Nimr has given us his thoughts about what he calls Israel's ethnic cleansing in Palestinian territories.
In reality, we know that the Israeli plans generally is to take the Palestinian land and to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from the land and to replace them with these settlers coming from all over the world. Now, the whole thing is in Israel, it's about time that the international community should understand and should see exactly the Israeli answers to all their questions concerning what's going on in this area or the peace talks or whatever the two-state solution that they are suggesting sometimes, that the Israeli answer to all these are, you know, is going on with its settlements and with the atrocities. And it's about time now for this international community to understand the nature of this colonialist, apartheid, racist regime in the area, and should take some kind of action against this kind of state.
The Israeli military has conducted another deadly raid in the occupied West Bank, killing a Palestinian man and injuring 16 others. Regime forces shot dead 29-year-old Mohammad Sabana during the raid that targeted Jenin refugee camp. According to Palestinian media, a large group of Israeli forces as well as scores of military vehicles were involved in the operation. The troopers evacuated Palestinians, including children and women, from their homes and held them outside. Several Palestinians have also been arrested. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has denounced the raid. It says Palestinians won't give up their resistance in the face of Israeli atrocities. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, to get more details on the Israeli raid.
Well, the operation to the Jenin area was in the first place meant to destroy or demolish the home of Palestinian martyr Raad Khazem, who carried out a shooting operation in Tel Aviv. Of course, Israeli forces raided the building where the apartment of Palestinian martyr Hazem was included, and the clashes took place between Palestinians and Israeli forces. We are speaking about a large number of Israeli soldiers and vehicles. According to witnesses, over 100 Israeli military vehicles and a bulldozer raided Jenin area, and it was the largest number of forces storming the city in the recent months. Of course, we are speaking, according to Palestinian paramedics, about one Palestinian martyr, Mohammed Sabani. 16 Palestinians were wounded during this operation, and a number of Palestinians had been arrested also during the Israeli storm to Jenin area.
A U.S. federal judge approves a request by former President Donald Trump to appoint a special master as the FBI investigates documents seized from his Florida home. The ruling enables Trump to designate a legal representative to review the bulk of seized evidence and decide what is off limits to prosecutors. A judge has also ordered a halt to the Justice Department's investigation of the records. The department's probe looks at Trump's removal of government documents from the White House when he left the Oval Office in January 2021. FBI agents took 11 sets of such records, including top secret files from the ex-president's Mar-a-Lago residence during a raid last month. The Canadian Prime Minister condemns weekend stabbing attacks in Saskatchewan province, saying such violent incidents have become all too commonplace in the country. Justin Trudeau says the incidents are shocking and heartbreaking. At least 10 people were killed and 18 more were injured in the stabbings that took place on Sunday. Canadian police say they found the body of one of the two brothers suspected of the attacks. A massive manhunt is underway for the other brother. The incident is one of the deadliest mass killings in Canadian history. Canada's worst incident of gun violence took place in 2020. It saw a man kill 22 people in Nova Scotia province. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
Some of our Friday prayer leaders took part in economic activities in the past. They failed in these activities because they did not know what they were doing. Others took advantage of the situation and they became a burden on the system, and some are still continuing with this. Never get involved in economic matters. The administration of clerical organizations is up to the people. Gentlemen, unfortunately, some are ashamed to say that seminaries are supported by the people. This is nothing to be ashamed of. Rather, it is something to be proud of. What this means is that they do not need the government or those in power to give them money. This is a big advantage. It allows them to easily stand by the people. You see, seminaries have sided with the people and have stayed alongside the people in many different cases. they have been able to easily confront the various governments and those in power. If there were those amongst the clergy who had connections or received funding from a certain place, they were not able to stand by the people and they remained behind. No, we receive funds from the people and there is nothing wrong with that. It is the same with the Friday prayers. People need to help and they do help. When you take part in economic activities, set up businesses and do these sort of things, people say, these people already have money. Not only will they not help you, they will also have expectations from you. So, these were some points about the behavior of a Friday prayer leader.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to say a few things about the sermons now. First of all, it should be noted that the Friday prayer sermons and the Friday prayer leaders are spokesmen for the Islamic revolution. That's it. No one should expect anything other than this from the Friday prayer leader. He is a spokesman for the Islamic revolution. He explains the foundations of the revolution. He calls for what the revolution calls for and he belongs to the revolution. It's always been like this. It's been like this throughout history. The Friday prayer leader will have carried out a great duty if he is able to convey religious and revolutionary concepts according to the needs of the present day. There are many concepts of the revolution that we once proclaimed, followed, and are still following to this day. But today, the same concepts should be explained and conveyed with a new language, with words that are suitable for the present age.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The crisis in Ukraine, which began in February 2022, is arguably the most important event since the fall of the Soviet Union, which has had global ramifications. The crisis has given rise to new alliances and enmities. There have been various attempts and roadmaps to resolve the conflict. Messages have also been exchanged between the involved parties through various means to put an end to the crisis. In the latest such example, it has emerged that Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who visited Russia's capital Moscow earlier this week, was carrying a message from a European leader to Russia over Ukraine. Although the name of the European leader is unknown, some reports say the Western leader in question is the French President Emmanuel Macron.
Indeed, this is the fact that Iran is emerging now as a very important, not just regional player, but global player. And the fact that Iran is getting involved not just in resolving its own problems with the United States and Israel, but in resolving global issues such as the NATO push to the east, is an important new step for Iran on the world stage. Indeed, this is a historic moment for Iran.
The details of the peace initiative have also not been revealed, but Amir Abdullahian said he discussed humanitarian issues, the prisoners, and the issue of the Zaporizhia nuclear plant. Since the conflict began in February, Iran has conveyed messages between Moscow and Kiev several times, but this is the first publicized instance of Tehran delivering a message from Europe. Iran has often expressed its readiness to act as an honest broker in any talks aimed at bringing an end to the conflict. And now the mediation role of Tehran between Moscow, Kiev, and the West testifies to the growing importance of Iran at the international stage.
The word on the street, as they say, is that the party trying to help bring peace in this conflict is France. And the reason why France is doing this is an attempt on the local part of France to become a more important power within Europe. It has been more than 20 years since France has done anything independently in Europe without the go-ahead from Germany. And what this signifies is that France is attempting, at least the current administration in the French government, is attempting to separate itself somewhat from Germany, which has been the leader of the EU.
The conflict between Russia and Ukraine has exposed deep problems within the EU. It has further highlighted the United States' influence over the bloc and the military alliance NATO. It's been reported that Russia and Ukraine were close to reaching a deal to end the war, which would have made Ukraine vow that it would never seek NATO membership. But the efforts were scuttled due to the Western pressure, most notably from the UK and the US. UK's outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson is said to have dictated to Volodymyr Zelensky that even if Kiev was ready to sign a deal with Russia, Ukraine's Western benefactors were not. Now, nearly 7 months into the war, European countries are beginning to feel the economic costs of their ambitions for the eastward expansion of NATO. The UK is now experiencing its worst inflation in years and is on the brink of a recession. Economists predict that inflation is likely to top 20% next year. EU countries are not doing better either, with annual inflation of 9.1% for August. Experts have warned of a winter of discontent and a catastrophic economic fallout if the crisis lingers on. It now appears that some NATO members led by the United States are ready to keep the war going on in Ukraine at Ukraine's cost, for their own benefits.
American intervention in Latin America began in 1823 when President James Monroe declared the continent to be a U.S. sphere of influence. Under the Monroe Doctrine, Washington claimed the right to intervene militarily across Latin America. That led to the Banana Wars, in which the U.S. military fought to reassert American power and monopoly of plantations in Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. Washington has so far orchestrated and supported many coups across Latin America that have been characterized as U.S. foreign policy in the region since the early 20th century. Throughout history, there's been a lot of U.S. meddling in Latin America, especially in Central America. U.S. foreign policy towards Central America heightened during the Cold War and the spread of the leftist movements and revolutions. Many believe that the success of the Cuban Revolution in the 1950s made the U.S. nervous to think that there could be political superpowers like the USSR at the time, leading them in getting involved in what they perceived as their backyard. All this set the stage for a sustained and violent U.S. intervention across Central America, backing vicious local allies in wars that claimed thousands of lives and displaced millions. The latest U.S. attempts of intervening in Latin America in its long list of interventions is considered as what it calls funding for democracy promotion in Cuba. Havana has, however, slammed the move, saying it's illegal and aimed at toppling the government. Let's not forget the USAID program in Cuba. As it was reported at the time, the U.S. secretly created Cuban Twitter, to stir unrest and undermine the government of President at the time, Fidel Castro. It started a social network built on texts in hope that it could be used to organize smart mobs to trigger a Cuban Spring. The island nation, which is currently facing its worst economic crisis in decades amid U.S. sanctions, announced electricity blackouts this month. Along with soaring food, fuel, and medicine prices as shortage grips, people are observing long queues for necessities. The U.S. trade embargo, which has been in place against Cuba since 1962, was reinforced under former President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump's successor has also chosen to follow the same path. U.S. intervention has gone far enough that some Congress lawmakers have even advocated for bombing strikes.
We can go back to 1960, in fact, and the Mallory Rubottom memo, it's a State Department memo, that lays out the scenario that Cuba is experiencing today. It says that as secretly as inconspicuously as possible to disrupt the livelihoods, the employment, the income of the Cuban people. So this has been a policy ever, you know, since 1960, April 6, 1960. The other part of that is that they intend to press the people into rebellion against the government. So clearly, regime change is part of the program.
Venezuela plunged into political turmoil after the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido launched a botched coup to oust democratically elected President Nicolas Maduro. The attempted coup, which came with the green light off and support of Washington, is yet another example of Washington's intentions with Latin America. The U.S. has even imposed several rounds of sanctions against Venezuela aimed at ousting Maduro and replacing him with Guaido. The sanctions, which include the illegal confiscation of Venezuelan assets abroad and an economic blockade, have caused poverty, a lack of access to basic goods, gasoline shortages, and power cuts. But despite all this, the U.S. seems to have failed in its foreign policy regarding not only Venezuela, but Latin America as a whole, where most of the recently elected presidents have already expressed their ambitions of distancing themselves from the U.S. and establishing stronger ties among themselves.
And, you know, you're not asking this, but there is a new international realignment, and partly I think it's because of these blockades, because of the unilateral action by the United States against countries that are developing to impose its own financial rule on other countries. The United States needs to learn that other countries have a right to determine their own form of government, that their own way of living, that the people in those countries have that right without the United States putting them into debt, without sanctioning them, without creating hardships, and without military attack.
The latest turn of events is also an indication of the U.S.'s failed sanctions policy. Venezuela has, despite the sanctions, managed to double its oil production recently thanks to Iran's help. Iran itself, which is also heavily sanctioned by Washington, is also a prime example of the U.S.'s failed policies, as it has managed to withstand the economic pressure while gradually finding ways around them.
The G7 countries have agreed to implement a price cap on Russian imports, despite warnings from the Kremlin to hold sales to countries imposing the restriction. Finance ministers of the United States, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and the United Kingdom agreed on a plan to ban the provisions of services that enable maritime transportation of Russian-origin crude oil and petroleum products globally. This means importers seeking shipping services and insurance cover from companies based in G7 and EU countries would need to adhere to a price cap to transport Russian oil. The level of the cap is still being discussed. The German finance minister has stated the purpose of the move as such.
We want to limit Russia's revenues and at the same time reduce economic damage to our societies. This price cap on Russian oil exports is designed to reduce Putin's revenues.
The cap is expected to take effect at the same time as the next EU embargoes on Russian oil in early December. Moscow has warned that it will retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement the restriction. The Kremlin has warned that a price ceiling will significantly destabilize the oil markets, resulting in scarcity in global oil markets and soaring prices for European consumers. The ban is part of a range of measures taken by the West targeting Russia for the war in Ukraine. In response to the war, the US decided to prohibit the import of oil, refined petroleum products, natural gas, and coal from Russia. These restrictions on Russian energy imports have contributed to higher gas prices and increased inflation pressure across the US. Washington's European allies are in no better condition. The European countries have plunged into a devastating energy crisis. Consumers are facing huge bills and the highest rates of inflation since the 1980s. Shell's chief executive officer has earlier warned that gas shortages could persist for several years, raising the prospect of continued energy rationing. Russian energy giant Gazprom has halted flows via the crucial Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Europe. The company cited an oil leak and didn't give a timeline of when the shipments might resume. This comes in the wake of the G7 countries' decision to impose a price cap on Russian oil. The continued shutdown of the pipeline could exacerbate the energy crisis in Europe, as it is the biggest pipeline for gas from Russia, accounting for about 35% of Europe's total Russian gas imports last year. Russia had already threatened to retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement a price cap. Since June, Gazprom has slashed flows through Nord Stream 1 to just 20% of its capacity, citing maintenance issues as a dispute over a missing turbine caught up in Western export sanctions. It has also cut off supplies to several unfriendly European countries and energy companies over their refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The West has already sanctioned many Russian energy exports, but Moscow has continued to earn billions of dollars a month by diverting oil to countries such as China and India. China's crude imports from Russia soared to a record level in May, ousting Saudi Arabia as the country's top supplier.
The prices that are being paid for Russian oil are far higher than the cost of actually extracting that oil. So what the Russians are taking advantage, in other words, of the situation they're imposing by their boycotts and by the war in Ukraine.
The West is trying to sever the Kremlin's revenues by imposing a ceiling for Russian exports. But Moscow has proved that it can reduce the exporting of its products to Europe and still have mass revenues. Iran's central bank says Tehran and Moscow have officially started doing business in their national currencies, adding both countries are considering de-dollarizing other parts of their economic ties. Tehran and Moscow had long been seeking to create a mechanism to replace the US dollar with their national currencies, rial and ruble, as part of a joint de-dollarization agenda, regardless of the tough economic sanctions in place against the two nations. Iran and Russia have both been subjected to tough economic sanctions by Western countries and are determined to deepen their economic cooperation, adding that there are great capacities for increasing the volume of bilateral trade. Several officials in Tehran and Moscow have repeatedly accused the United States of using the dollar as an instrument to wage economic and political war. China is another economic and political power that has opted to move toward de-dollarization. In fact, Iran, Russia, and China have discussed the de-dollarization of their trade for decades and have considered launching an alternative for the worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication Global Network, or SWIFT. Following the breakout of the Russia-Ukraine conflict early this year, U.S.-led Western governments imposed several rounds of financial sanctions on Moscow, including freezing its foreign exchange reserves. The thought that the U.S. may move to confiscate one's assets in case they refuse to accept what Washington dictates has caused more countries to consider diversifying their reserve assets away from U.S. dollar. Consequently, many countries have turned away from European democracies and Washington. Regardless of who wins the Ukraine war, the United States and its allies will be the strategic losers. Russia will probably build closer relations with China and other countries on the Eurasian continent, including India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf Arab countries.
We are seeing a deepening of ties unlike any other time that we've seen before. And ultimately, what this means is that the relationship between Russia and China is no longer being governed by the same economic rules that had governed it prior to this year. That is that Russian rubles are being traded. They're no longer doing business in dollars. And ultimately, that is hurting the United States. And it's going to change the dollar's hegemony.
In recent years, with the increased weaponization of the dollar and Washington's use of the dollar to sanction the so-called unruly countries in America's eyes, many countries in the world have awakened and begun to experiment trading in their own national currencies. Since the U.S. has been using the dollar and sanctions as a weapon to hurt other economies, its competitors have no obligation to help the U.S. maintain the dollar hegemony. The dollar's decades-long dominance has placed America in a strong position to dictate the terms of global trade and finance for the last 70 years. But this time, Russia wants to do something different, as Moscow is determined to launch a counter-offensive against Western sanctions and the dollar-centric global financial system. Following the unprecedented Western financial and economic sanctions, Moscow asked all unfriendly countries that are imposing sanctions on it to pay for their fuel purchases in Russia's rubles. The measure immediately helped stabilize the value of the ruble and significantly diffused the negative impact of Western sanctions. In addition to crude oil and natural gas, some economists have suggested Moscow extend the requirement for importers of Russia's grain, chemical fertilizers, and other products to transact in rubles instead of dollars or euros.
I think what we're witnessing now is the birth of a multipolar world order. And what that means ultimately is that after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s, the United States became the single hegemonic global power. And what we are seeing now is that the United States, after two decades of brutal wars in the Middle East, in North Africa, of the rampant imperialist expansion and regime change policies and nation building policies of the US regime, that now Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, South Africa, many countries are coming together and saying no more to US expansionism.
Russia and China certainly are engaged in a bid to change the U.S. rules-based order, but instead of trying to replace one hegemony, that is the dollar, with another, they are encouraging the rest of the world to assert their autonomy and independence.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
You're listening to Hosseiniya from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Rezavian. لبیک یا حسین.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیک یا ابا عبدالله الحسین. Brothers and sisters, my condolences for the time period of Muharram and Ashura and for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Welcome to the program Husseiniyye. Ziyarat Ashura is a great gift to us from Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam. In this ziyarat, we learn many things. The first thing that we mentioned was that we learn about bala and calamity, that life has difficulties and challenges for us, and that we learn from Imam Hussein alayhi salam how to deal with our bala, and we understand that the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was to endeavor the bala that God had brought for him, the trial that Allah had brought for him, and that he persevered and that he amazed the angels with his patience. Today we're going to talk about another aspect of Ziyarat Ashura, and we read from the Ziyarat that we beseech God and we ask him, أَنْ يُعْطِيَنِي بِمُصَابِ بِكُمْ, to recompense me with my misfortunes for you. We ask Allah to give us recompense because we have made the bala of Imam Hussein our bala. أَفْضَلَ مَا يُعْطِي مُصَابًا بِمُصِيبَتِهِ, the highest that he, God, gives as compensation for misfortunes that has afflicted anyone. Brothers and sisters, when misfortunes happen on somebody, God gives them the reward. But here in Ziyarat Ashura, we are asking Allah to give us the best reward that you give a musab, a person that affliction has happened to him. As if we take the bala of Imam Hussein and we are making it our own bala, we're making it our own calamity. Therefore, we are learning from Ziyarat Ashura to have huzn, to have grief, to have sorrow in this Muharram. And this is an attribute of the faithful. This is the attribute of the sincere. Then this Muharram, they are truly grieving for Imam Hussein. They are truly sad for Imam Hussein. This is the second step. So the first step was bala and understanding the calamity of Ashura. The second thing is now grieving. Now that you know it is the worst bala that happened upon anybody, and it is the bala that the angels understand, it is the bala of the Ahlul Islam, the people of Islam, we now understand that we should grieve, we should become sad for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that we should shed tears for him. If we look at the narrations, we understand that all the prophets cried for Imam Hussein. Even Adam, when he understood about what happened to Imam Hussein, he began to cry. One of the stories I'd like to share to you with you today is the story of Prophet Zakaria. Prophet Zakaria was taught the names, the al-asma. What are the names? Prophet Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Hassan, and Hussein. He was taught these names. This narration is in the book of Ihtijaj, al-Ihtijaj of Sheikh Tabarsi. When he learned these names, the name of Imam Hussein was taught to him. It says in the narration that it says, إِذَا ذَكَرْتُ الْحُسَيْنِ تَدْمَعُ عَيْنِي. When I hear this name, Allah, you have taught me the name of Hussein, I begin to cry. And then he learns the story of Karbala. What happens to Prophet Zakaria when he learns about Imam Hussein? What would happen to him? It says, فَلَمَّا سَمِعَ ذَلِكَ زَكَرِيَّا لَمْ يُفَارِقْ مَسْجِدَهُ ثَلَاثَةَ أَيَّامٍ, 3 days he kept himself in the masjid. وَمَنَعَ فِيهِنَّ النَّاسِ مِنْ دُخُولَ عَلَيْهِ, He didn't allow anybody to enter. وَأَغْبَلَ عَلَى الْبُكَاءِ And he began to cry and cry and cry. Prophet Zakaria, knowing that what happened to Imam Hussein, his brothers and sisters, the reality of Ashura can only be witnessed by the prophets and their successors. They truly know what happened to Imam Hussein. They can truly understand the batin and the essence of Karbala. So what did Prophet Zakaria do dua for? He wanted reward. We say, give us some of the reward of the musab, of those that have been afflicted. Give us some of this reward. He wanted the reward of calamity, of huzn, of patience. So he did a very special dua. He says in this narration, Elahi urzuqni walada. God, grant me a son that I love, a son that I like, and then take away that son for me so that I can in the same way have the affliction of the noble messenger of Allah, that he knows that his son, because in the traditions the Prophet talks about Imam Hussein as his son, even though it is his grandson, that when Allah took away and put bala in Imam Hussein and martyred Imam Hussein, that is the bala of the Holy Prophet. So in the same way, give me a son so I can share that bala of the Holy Prophet, knowing that his grandson, knowing that his son will be martyred. And Allah gave him Yahya, and Yahya was martyred and is very similar in story and very similar to Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Standing here alone, so far from home, a place where angels cry, while infant children die. Hussein has said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him leave. They cry out, Hussein, ya Hussein.
We were talking about huzn, we're talking about grief. And we shared the story of Prophet Zakaria and the book of Al-Ihtijaj. And we said that Prophet Zakaria, knowing what would befall Imam Hussein, that he began to cry for 3 days. And he did a very special dua that he could share in some of the huzn of Karbala. Having grief itself is not something good. In the traditions we have, it's something discouraged. It's not good to be sad. But when you have grief for Imam Hussein, that is not grief. It is actually connection to God. It is actually spiritual enjoyment. That is the difference between having grief for Imam Hussein, having sorrow for Imam Hussein, and having sorrow for your own worldly affairs. Look at some of the traditions we have. From Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, we have the tradition in Al-Kafi that Nafasul Mahmum Lana Al-Muqtam Lidhulmina Tasbih. The breath of one who is saddened in our account is grieved for the oppression done to us is tasbih, is glorification. Just as you say, Subhanallah, you are this breath that you're taking because you understand how sad the event of Ashura is, it is tasbih for you. It is glorification of Allah. وَحَمُّهُ لِأَمْرِنَا عِبَادَةً The grief for our cause is worship. So the sad breath is tasbih, is glorification of God. And the grief that happens, the hum that happens, is actually in the tradition worship of God. Therefore, this grief is much different than other types of grief. This is worship. This is connection to God. This is something that's very worthy, very precious. Look at it, all the traditions we have about the tears that somebody sheds for Imam Hussein, what reward they'll get. Look at the traditions that we have, those that recite poetry for Imam Hussein, what reward they'll get. those that have majlis for Imam Hussein, look at the reward they will get. So having grief is the second part of our spiritual journey for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And of course, Imam Hussein does not need our tears. Imam Hussein, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, as we read in Ziyad Jami Kabira, ذَلَّ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ لَكُمْ. Everything is humble for the Ahlul Bayt. They do not need our tears. We need to cry for Imam Hussein. We need to cry so that we can link our hearts closer to Imam Hussein. When a person's heart gets attached to another person, they spontaneously become good. They spontaneously become like that person. That is one of the best ways for us to change ourselves, to change ourselves and benefit from Ashura, to become more like Imam Hussein, is to link our hearts with Imam Hussein, to grieve like Imam Hussein, to have sorrow like Imam Hussein alayhi salam had sorrow. As we read in Ziyarat Ashura, we read, Alhamdulillahi ala azim raziyati, at the end. Allah, praise be, all praise be to Allah for my great misfortune. May Allah, I thank God, alhamdulillah, I say, for this great raziyah, this great misfortune. So in this Ashura, in this Muharram, if you feel grief for Imam Hussein, if you feel saddened by the event of Karbala, know that this is a blessing for you. Know that this is worship. Know that this is tasbih. Know that this is the second step in the spiritual journey of reaching Maqam al-Mahmud, reaching the praiseworthy station. And we thank Allah for these tears. We thank Allah that He gave us the ability to mourn for Imam Hussein.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The leader of the British Labour Party, Sir Keir Starmer, has been conducting a witch hunt against pro-Palestine members of his own party. His notoriously pro-Israel views are well known, but today we'll be looking at Sir Keir's relationship with a little-known but influential law firm called Mishkan Diriya. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to delve into the background to this story. But before we get into that discussion, here's Bianca Rahimi with an investigation about the role of Mishkan Diriya in pro-Israel lobbying.
Mishkan Diriya is a law and lobbying firm based in London and Singapore. It is a vast operation, including over 600 lawyers. It generates hundreds of millions of pounds of profit yearly. But what lurks behind this tidy veneer? Mishkan Diriya came about through a merger by Baron Victor Mishkan and Barlett Diriya. Victor Mishkan had secretly worked as an intermediary between Israel and Jordan, providing his home as the site of meetings between Israeli President Shimon Peres and King Hussein of Jordan. Victor Mishkan later went on to reign as vice president of the Board of Deputies, a lobby group in Britain which has admitted having a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy and strong links with the Israeli military and Ministry of Strategic Affairs. The law firm and lobby